This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's session. My name is Stephen Morris. I'm with Greensboro Revolutionary Socialists. Thank you for coming to today's talk, From Chavez to Maduro, Understanding Venezuela Today. So we have two speakers today. Mara Garcia is a socialist who organized with Marea Socialista in Venezuela for years and now organizes with the Tempest Collective and locally with Greensboro Revolutionary Socialists. Anderson Bean is a sociologist and assistant teaching professor at North Carolina A&T University in Greensboro, North Carolina. He is the author of Communes and the Venezuelan State, The Struggle for Participatory Democracy in a Time of Crisis. He is a member of Tempest Collective and Greensboro Revolutionary Socialist. So our speakers are going to speak for about 50 minutes, and then we're going to have a discussion time, and I'll explain how we do stack and everything then. And then we'll hand it back to the speakers for like the last 10 minutes so they can reiterate all their wonderful points, I'm sure. Take it away, whomever.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. Okay. For the first decade or so, the center of Venezuela and its political project called the Bolivarian Process was an inspiration around the world, particularly to those on the left. During this process, the material well-being of Venezuelans improved, social inequality was drastically reduced, and a new and innovative experience in participatory democracy enabled traditionally excluded sectors of Venezuelans to actively participate in the political process. The Bolivarian process also inspired anti-imperialists worldwide by challenging U.S. dominance in the region, whether through its rejection of U.S.-backed free trade agreements or by creating alternative institutions to promote regional integration. Fast forward to today, and Venezuela is the largest crisis in its history and one of the worst in Latin America history. From 2013 to 2021, Venezuela's GDP contracted by more than 75%. Inflation reached 130,000% in 2018, the highest in the world. Over 80% of households are classified as poor. The monthly minimum wage is equivalent of $2, the lowest in the whole Latin America. And even when including bonus, it's 8 times less than the U.S. limit for absolute poverty. Since 2016, over 8 million of Venezuelans have fled the country looking for a better life. By 2020, Venezuela became the country with the highest number of displaced people in Latin America, and the second highest in the world, second only to Syria. Since 2014, the numbers of Venezuelans who have applied for asylum in countries has increased by 4,000%. The crisis seems to have not ended in sight. What was an inspiration now appears as a nightmare. How did Venezuela go from the highest minimum wage in Latin America to the lowest? How did Venezuela go from being seen as a model of social progress to the site of perhaps the deepest crisis in the history of Latin America? What factors led to and contribute to this crisis? These are questions that Anderson and I will try to answer today. To understand the crisis, we need to start with the years leading up to Chavez's election in 1998. I will cover this period up to Chavez's death in 2013. And Anderson will continue from there, discussing the Maduro era up to the present. Hugo Chavez won the presidential elections in December 1998, following a decade of neoliberal policies in Venezuela. The previous period had seen two successive governments implement neoliberal economic programs. These governments and their political programs were met with massive popular resistance. The resistance included a popular uprising in 1989 that disrupted the two-party political system established in 1958, two nationalist and leftist military uprising, and the removal of a sitting president by parliament on corruption charges. The Bolivarian process that began with the election of Chavez was a popular response to the crisis of legitimacy of the political model of represented democracy that had been in place since 1958, the failure of the political economy system that had been in place since 1958 had become evident by the mid-80s. The popular uprising in 1989, known as the Caracazo, was one expression of the discontent of the population had with the system that did not satisfy their fundamental needs. The government responded to the uprising with brutal repression, leaving upwards of 3,000 Venezuelans dead. This violence against ordinary Venezuelans reinforced the view that those who government did not deserve to enjoy the popular support that has sustained the ruling two-party's political model for three decades. But because the left was in crisis and there was an absence of alternative political options, the two-party system will stay in power for another decade. During this decade, the decomposition of the political model continued. In 1992, Chavez led a military rebellion and a larger sector of middle-ranking officers decided to join the rebellion. The uprising was defeated, but the dominant bloc was further fragmented. During the 1990s, amidst a worsening economic crisis, the dominant bloc adopted neoliberal policies. Both the Carlos Andrés Pérez and Rafael Caldera administrations implemented restructuring programs, which continue to deteriorate the well-being of ordinary Venezuelans. Citizen rejection of this neoliberal term was expressed in 1998 elections. Chavez campaigning as a popular alternative to 20 years of economic failure and 40 years of discredited two-party political model. Chavez's main campaign proposal was to convene an assembly to draft a new constitution. He also advocated for a political economy program close to that of welfare state. On the campaign trail, Laura and Tony Blair, Chavez spoke of funding a third way between capitalism and socialism. However, Chavez's government quickly transcended this framework, moving to a political and economic model closer to that of Cuba. By 2005, 6 years after his election, in a speech to the World Social Forum, Chavez announced that he supported the creation of socialism in Venezuela under the banner of 21st century socialism. The basic principles of this socialism were participatory and protagonist democracy of popular power, as opposed to liberal representative democracy, equality and justice, and civil military unity. By the end of the 20th century, there was a considerable discontent and rejection among the popular class of neoliberal adjustments and their disastrous result. Labor rights were reversed, inequality was on rise. The reality forced many progressive parties across the region to speak out against neoliberalism and to propose alternative path to neoliberalism. Chavez's election in 1998 contributed to the reversal of neoliberalism in the region and was able to reverse the process of falling income levels and increasing inequality. The Chavista government was able to reverse the process of privatization of public companies, including most importantly in the oil sector. Chavez's project was defined by its anti-neoliberalism and its attempts to overcome oil renterism, and its replacement by neo-developmentalist policies, with a strong state intervention in strategic areas. The reversal of neoliberal policies on his predecessors led to a polarized struggle between the government, the political right, and the traditional business sector. The first major transformative step taken by the government was the convening of a Constituent Assembly in April of 1999, the resulting a new constitution greatly broadened social rights and introduced new political rights. The Chavez period also revigorated the workers' struggle, alternating labor relations and forms of ownership. The new constitution ratified fundamental workers' rights, including granting the right to unionize, the right to strike, the right to collective bargaining, the autonomy of trade unions from the employer and the state, the right to social security as a public service, and the obligation of the state to guarantee it. The right to work, the inclusion of the new rights such as equality and equity between men and women in the exercise of the right to work, the recognition of a household work as economy activity that creates, add values, and produce wealth and provide welfare, the right to housewife, to social security, the progressiveness of labor rights, and finally, the reduction of the daytime working day from 48 to 44 hours a week. In the year of the following, Venezuela workers began to reorganization of their trade unions structures, raising demands and political proposals that confronted and transcended the previous neoliberal decade and opened up prospects for the anti-capitalist direction of the Venezuelan political process. Is everything okay? Attacks on the Chavez government and the Bolivarian process by both the U.S. and the domestic elites have been a constant feature since Chavez elections. A failed coup in April 2002 was soon followed by an employee-led lockout in December, carried out by the Punto Fijista elite. Both failed to overthrow Chavez government. Resistance to the lockout culminated in the wave of workers' struggles throughout the country. These failures of the business class were taken as a victory by the sector of the Bolivarian workers who were beginning to organize independently. During this time, Venezuelan workers began to reclaim companies that had been shut down during the lockout and demanding the nationalization or renationalization of industries controlled by private sector. At the same time, the workers' struggle began to experiment with innovative ways of organizing productive activity through workers' council and workers' control, ideas that resonate with the Bolivarian government and eventually became state policies. Workers' control, which became a rally cry during the 2002 and 2003 strike, led to the slogan, "Factory Stop It, Factory Occupy," in workers' controls of productive activity. This movement resulted in workers occupying numerous companies that had halted operations, including Venepal in Carabobo, Venezolana de Válvulas in Los Teques, Textil Phoenix in Guárico, Crystal Car Perfumes in Caracas, and others. When Chavez ordered the expropriation of Venepal in 2004, workers' control began to be considered an unofficial policy of Venezuela's state. Later, in 2009, it was officially adopted as a government policy in the Guayana Socialist Plan. The goal of workers' control was to enable workers to fully exercise participatory and protagonist democracy, both within and beyond the factory. It represented an experiment in the workers' struggle to replace the bourgeois state with a new state transition into socialism. In May of 2012, Chavez passed a new labor law, which restored the rights that had been stripped away in the years previous and introduced a range of new labor and political rights. The approval of the new law was a monumental achievement in the workers' struggles against neoliberalism and against capitalism exploitation in general. Article 25 states that socialist labor process has its essential objective to overcome the forms of capitalism exploitation. Perhaps the most striking example of Chavez's anti-neoliberal program was its nationalization of a range of large companies throughout the country. Between 2007 and 2009, Chavez nationalized oil fields in Orinoco Bell, the electricity company Electricidad de Caracas, the largest telecommunication company CanTV, the steel company Sidor, Venezuela's main cement industry, several briquettes companies, the pie factory TAPSA, 76 medium-sized companies that provide service to the oil industry, the sardine process company La Gaviota, the largest coffee company Café Fama de América, the bank, Banco de Venezuela, among others. Chavez government improved workers' incomes and living conditions by introducing social welfare program called Missions, health programs in neighborhoods, construction of popular housing, school food programs, household appliance through prices initiative, expansion of the public university system, expansion of the pension system to homemakers and non-contributing workers, among others, all improve the general living conditions of the working class. Although the programs executed by Chavez was not, strictly speaking, as a socialist or communist program, his performance at the head of the state was a 180 degrees turn in relationship to the previous government of Venezuela since independence. During Chavez's presidency, there was a rise of left-wing forces throughout Latin America, leading to a radical change in the entire Latin America political landscape. The anti-imperialist discourse confronting the U.S. government and its traditional influence in the continent was strengthened as never before in history. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mata, for giving that really important history of the origins of the Bolivarian process. So I'm going to pick up where Mata left off and discuss the Maduro years, and in doing so, try to explain the causes of the economic crisis, and then briefly discuss what the less positional Venezuela should be. So first, I want to start by talking about some prevailing perspectives on the causes of the crisis in Venezuela. So from the perspective of the U.S. state, so which this, of course, includes the Democrats and the Republicans, alongside the Venezuelan right wing, the crisis is a result of socialism. For them, the crisis is a product of the Bolivarian Revolution's attempt to usher in a socialist project. Socialism, or any attempt to create any society that diverges from capitalism, is always doomed to fail. Meanwhile, much of the left, particularly the Anglophone left, argues that the crisis can be explained primarily by U.S. sanctions imposed on Venezuela, coupled with other attempts by the U.S. state in collaboration with the Venezuelan right-wing opposition to undermine the Venezuelan economy in order to carry out a regime change to unseat Maduro and put a complete end to the Bolivarian process. This perspective leads many on the left to at best ignore the role of the Maduro government in the crisis and at worst to defend and justify its anti-worker neoliberal program. So I will argue that both of these perspectives miss the mark. Both of these perspectives argue that Venezuela is a socialist economy, or at least is on the path towards building socialism. The former, of course, argues that this is precisely the cause of the crisis, that socialism fails. The latter argues that this is why the Maduro regime must be defended at all costs. So this argument is that socialism needs protection. So to understand the factors that led to the crisis in Venezuela, it's helpful to understand it's helpful to start with what is often called the commodities boom. So like many of the left-of-center progressive presidents in Latin America, much of Chavez's time in office coincided with the boom in commodity prices driven by demand from emerging markets like China and India. The price of commodities, the price of primary commodities such as soy, iron ore, copper, and most importantly oil, reached new highs. The price of oil and natural gas with the price of oil and natural gas so high, even a modest increase in royalties and taxes created a huge influx in state revenue. This increased revenue enabled Chavez to increase social spending, create various distribution programs, and improve the standard of living for the majority of Venezuelans. But this increased revenue also enabled the Chavista government to delay a series of crucial class questions or class decisions. Chavez was able to increase social spending without having to confront the capitalist class in any serious way. There was no real meaningful transformation of social property relations, no transformation of the international division of labor, and no challenge to the prerogatives of transnational capital, Importantly, there was no break with extractivism and no break with its dependence on export of minerals and hydrocarbons. In fact, Venezuela's dependence on oil exports increased during the Chavez and Maduro era, leaving the country more dependent on and beholden to global financial and oil markets. So because of this commodities boom, Chavez was able to reduce poverty and inequality and expand a variety of different social programs without confronting capital or the global capitalist order in any serious way. 70% of the economy remained in private capitalist hands throughout the Chavista era. Wealth may have been redistributed to some extent, but they did not change society's underlying class structure or seriously confront private property or profitability. This model and its mutually beneficial relationship between capital and labor rested on a fragile base and was only temporary because of its being contingent on high commodity prices, thus market forces. This delicate balance sustained itself until 2011-2012, when China's economy began to slow down, China's rates of growth dropped to the lowest since the 1990s. Once the Chinese economy began to slow, the high commodity prices that sustained the Chavez government began to fall, leading to crisis. The ability to appease both labor and capital came to an end with the end of the commodities boom. In 2015, commodity prices hit a 12-year low. The slowdown hit Venezuela particularly hard since oil exports accounted for 95% of its export earnings and oil revenues made up more than 90% of the government's budget. The end of the commodities boom forced the Chavista government to make a decision, a class decision that they had managed to delay while commodity prices were high. Now in a situation of austere state revenues, who was going to pay for the crisis? Was it going to be labor and regular working people, the social bases that supported and voted for Chavez into power? Or was it going to be a conflict with capital that had been delayed for years? This, as history would have it, was not a decision that Chavez had a chance to make. Chavez got sick with cancer in 2012, the same year that the boom went bust, and ended up dying at the beginning of 2013. Shortly afterwards, Nicolas Maduro was elected to replace Chavez, and the burden of resolving these questions fell on the new Maduro government. Here it's important to clearly define what Maduro inherited in order to contextualize his administration's response to the situation in Venezuela. Throughout the Chavez years, even during the apex of the Bolivarian process and the height of the commodities boom, and even with the gains that were made during these years, Venezuela remained a capitalist country and remains so to this day. Throughout both the Chavez and Maduro years, the overwhelming majority of the means of production remained in the hands of the private sphere and of the capitalist class. The control of the economy still remains in the hands of private capital. In fact, between the years 1999 and 2011, the private sector's share of economic activity actually increased from 65% to 71%. Production for private property continues to dominate the economy. The production and distribution of the majority of goods and services, including key industries like major food import and processing operations, pharmaceuticals, and auto parts, are still controlled by the private sector. In other words, the bourgeois state apparatus still endures. Even in instances where the state does own the means of production, like for example in the state-owned oil and natural gas company PDVSA, or the concrete and asphalt industries, it is the state bureaucracy that controls and makes all decisions in these industries rather than the workers. And in the instances of state control of industry and, and in the instances of state control of industry, in particular PDVSA, production and distribution are shaped by the logic of capital and capital accumulation. The oil industry represents 95% of the country's total exports, sold on the world market, and thus beholden to its capitalist logic. In other words, in neither the large extent private sector, nor in the majority of state-owned industries, do workers exercise control of the means of production. Moreover, despite the progressive language of participatory democracy and human rights, the 1999 Chavista Constitution gave significant protection to private property. Even Chavez spoke openly about how the transition to socialism had yet to come to fruition, nor would it in the near future, and that Venezuela remained a capitalist country. Here is Chavez on his weekly radio and television show, Alo Presidente. Quote, "Who would think to say that Venezuela is a socialist country? No, that would be to deceive ourselves. We are in a country that still lives in capitalism. We have only initiated a path. We are only taking steps against the world current, including towards a socialist project, but this is for the medium or long term." End quote. So if socialism was never achieved at the peak of the Chavez era, it's far more difficult to argue that socialism exists today in Venezuela. While there may have been openings to struggle for socialism within the Bolivarian process during the Chavez era, Maduro has reversed this process and become an obstacle to the struggle for liberation. However, the fact that Venezuela has remained a capitalist country has certainly not protected the country from U.S. aggression. Despite not being socialist, the U.S. state still saw Chavez and the Bolivarian process as a threat that needed to be dealt with. Preceding the Chavez era, the United States had close relations with Venezuela, one of its major oil suppliers. But Chavez quickly became an adversary of the U.S. due to several acts deemed unacceptable to Washington. Some of these include Chavez's renationalization of the nation's oil production and Venezuela's role in the defeat of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. Also under the South-South Regional Integration Agreements as alternatives to U.S.-sponsored and dominated free trade agreements. Further, more broadly speaking, the U.S. was displeased with Venezuela's radical redistribution programs, its anti-imperialist rhetoric, and that it was distancing itself from the U.S.'s sphere of influence. Maduro, rather than being anti-imperialist, has drawn the ire of the U.S. by strengthening its ties with stated adversaries of the U.S. state, namely Iran, Russia, and China. So Venezuela has thus ventured further out of the U.S. sphere of influence and cozied up with Washington's imperialist rival, China. Maduro has chosen to side with one imperialist power, China and Russia, against another, an unforgivable act to the U.S. state. U.S. interference in Venezuela affairs have the explicit goal of removing Maduro from power and replacing him with someone more compliant to U.S. interests. As a result, the U.S., since the early years of the Bolivarian process, have taken measures to undermine the project, destabilize the economy, and in several cases taken measures to overthrow both Chavez and Maduro. This has taken a number of forms over the past 25 years. In 2002, the U.S., in collaboration with the Venezuelan business class, attempted a coup to overthrow Chavez. He was removed from office for 47 hours before he was reinstated by mass mobilizations. From late 2002 to early 2003, the U.S. supported an oil lockout to bring oil production to a halt with the stated goal of forcing Chavez to resign. In 2014, the U.S. backed the Venezuelan right wing again in violent street protests called the Guarimbas for the La Salida, or the exit of Maduro. The U.S. again, in collaboration with sections of the Venezuelan right wing, attempted another coup in January of 2019 when Juan Guaido unconstitutionally declared himself the president of Venezuela. After the January coup failed to overthrow Maduro, Guaido tried again in April of 2019, but failed again. These are just a few examples of U.S. aggression towards Venezuela since the beginning of the Bolivarian process. The most relevant of these to understanding the current crisis in Venezuela is the U.S.-imposed sanctions, which began in 2014 and continue today. So although the crisis in Venezuela precedes U.S. sanctions, they have no doubt exacerbated the crisis and caused untold pain and misery for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. The U.S., under Obama, imposed its first round of sanctions in December of 2014. The Venezuelan Defense of Human Rights and Civil Society Act imposed targeted sanctions on Venezuela, including visa restrictions on various Venezuelan officials and their family members. Just a few months later, in March of 2015, Obama signed an executive order declaring Venezuela, quote, an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, and expanded the sanctions further. This executive order, which was the ostensible justification for Obama's second round of sanctions, set the stage for the sanctions that were to come under Trump. Finally, as one of Obama's last acts of president, in January of 2017, he extended the sanctions on Venezuela yet again. Picking up where Obama left off in the first month of taking office, Trump renewed and expanded the sanctions, all implemented within the remit of Obama's executive order. Over the course of Trump's presidency, his administration continued to expand and deepen the sanctions on the Venezuelan government. Most notably was Executive Order 13884, which froze all Venezuelan government assets in the United States and banned Americans from doing business with the Venezuelan government. The combination of legal and economic sanctions have imposed a litany of debilitating penalties on the Venezuelan government, driving the Venezuelan economy into even deeper problems than it was already in. U.S. institutions and citizens were prohibited from trading in Venezuelan debt. All government assets were frozen. The country was prevented from restructuring its foreign debt or payment schedules. Payments sent by countries participating in its program for preferential payment of oil were blocked. The sale of billions of dollars in trade credits were banned. Sanctions also closed off Venezuela to its most important oil market, the U.S. And confiscated properties abroad, like U.S.-based Citgo, which the state depended on for sources of income. These are but a few of the actions taken against Venezuela. The August 2017 sanctions critically impacted Venezuela's oil production, causing a loss of $6 billion in revenue in just 2018 alone. This figure is important because virtually every necessity, food, medicine, clean water, electricity, transportation, is funded through oil export revenue. In the years since, their impact has continued, deepened, and compounded. Sanctions have frozen $17 billion worth of the country's assets and were expected to cost the country around $11 billion in export losses in 2019. In other words, the sanctions are costing Venezuelans about $30 million a day. The Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research published a 2019 report detailing the effects of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. The authors, economists Mark Weisbrot and Jeffrey Sachs, reported that in the week of March 15th, U.S. imports of Venezuelan oil fell to zero for the first time, and they remained at zero for 2 weeks. Oil export earnings in 2019 were projected to fall by an unprecedented 67% from 2018 because of the tightening of sanctions. They also found that between 2017 and 2018 alone, the sanctions killed an estimated 40,000 Venezuelans and plunged many more into precarity. Over 300,000 Venezuelans were put at risk due to the lack of medicine and health care, including 80,000 HIV-positive Venezuelans who have gone without antiretroviral drugs for years. Additionally, obtaining needed cardiovascular medicine or insulin is a challenge for 16,000 Venezuelans who need dialysis, the 4 million with diabetes and hypertension, and the 16,000 people who have cancer. The UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution denouncing the U.S. sanctions, and one of its human rights experts said, quote, "The use of sanctions by outside powers to overthrow an elected government is in violation of all norms of international law." One UN official called the sanctions economic warfare. The strategy in the U.S. and the domestic right-wing opposition seems to be, to use the words of Richard Nixon, to make the economy scream. But despite the harm the sanctions have wrought in Venezuela and the various ways in which the sanctions have exacerbated and compounded the crisis, the sanctions are only part of the picture in the crisis that we find Venezuela in today. It's important to reiterate that the crisis began before the sanctions were imposed, and to fully understand the crisis and its origins, it's essential to analyze another major component, which is the economic mismanagement and neoliberal program of the increasingly authoritarian Maduro government. While the national and international opposition have not succeeded in taking political power in Venezuela, it has, to a large extent, managed to get the Maduro government, to legislate and defend policies that Chavismo had long opposed. Venezuelan economist Luis Salas writes that, quote, "There is not much difference between the economic program of the right-wing opposition and that of the Maduro government. The only difference with the opposition is that the government wants to reach agreements with the Russians, the Chinese, or the Turks, and the opposition with the Americans and the Europeans. They are capitalist alliances, but with different partners," end quote. This can be seen clearly in the Maduro administration, in the way in which the Maduro administration responded to the end of the commodities boom. So again, in a situation of newly austere state revenues, the question stood as to who would pay for the crisis, workers or capital. Almost without exception, Maduro chose to make the working class pay, the very class that supported the Bolivarian process. Despite maintaining the socialist and anti-imperialist rhetoric of Chavez, Maduro carried out a regression and reversal of many of the most popular aspects of the Bolivarian project. As critical Chavista and member of Marea Socialista Roberto Lopez argues, quote, "The inauguration of Nicolas Maduro as president in 2013 meant the almost total abandonment of the anti-neoliberal program and the return of the same economic policies implemented in the last decade of the 20th century. Maduro maintained the same radical discourse as his predecessor and presented his government as a genuinely workerist or socialist one, which had the backing of the ruling class. However, in office, he has implemented a real change of economic course, opening the doors to neoliberal policies in a framework of growing authoritarianism. The reality of the Venezuelan economy, more than 8 years into Maduro's rule, ranks as the worst performance in the world. End quote. There are numerous instances where Maduro's response to the end of the commodities boom contributed to the crisis through anti-worker, neoliberal policies, and increasingly authoritarian actions. For the purpose of this talk, I will briefly discuss seven of them. That wasn't meant to be a joke. But I'll take it. I'll take it. Okay, so the first is the Arco Minero project. In 2016, the Maduro administration opened the Orinoco mining belt for mining exploitation. This territory makes up 12% of the country's area, is a repository of minerals like gold, oil, gas, bauxite, coltan, and the country's principal sources of fresh water. Also, just to put this in perspective, 12% of the Venezuelan country is the equivalent to an area that is larger than the entire country of Cuba, also significantly larger than the entire country of Portugal. So imagine selling the entire country of Portugal to multinational corporations. We'll get to more of that in a second. Where was I? So the project has been an environmental and social disaster, and it has displaced populations, particularly indigenous populations, poisoned rivers and land, destroyed mountain ecologies, and has disrupted the fragile ecosystem of the rainforests. The project was promoted as a solution to the country's declining GDP and depleted reserves. Maduro was correct that something had to be done, but this solution was an abandonment of national sovereignty and a return to the same neoliberal, neocolonial arrangements that social movements, workers' movements, and the Bolivarian process had been fighting against for decades. Venezuela was on the cutting edge of anti-neoliberalism in the region at the end of the century, and the Arco Minero is a major reversal and setback to that project. In fact, a similar plan was rejected by Chavez years before due to environmental concerns and in recognition of indigenous communities' human and territorial rights. Maduro's plan of privatization of the nation's extractive industries was also an abandonment of and reversal of Chavez's strategy of state control of resources and the socialization of its profits. For the project, Maduro invited 150 multinational corporations from around the world, including the U.S., China, Canada, Russia, to bid for concessions. Extremely favorable conditions were offered to multinationals to exploit Venezuelans' mineral resources. Many of the multinational corporations that Maduro offered favorable contracts to were corporations that Chavez had excluded from the country years before. In fact, the first offer was made to Barrick Gold Corporation, a giant Canadian gold mining corporation that Chavez kicked out of the country a decade prior. In 2011, when Chavez nationalized the mines, Barrick demanded hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation. But to lure Barrick back into the country, Maduro not only agreed to pay this so-called debt, but also offered the corporation both a 10-year tax holiday and pledged to develop the regional infrastructure at the state's expense. Socialist Mike Gonzalez accurately describes the project as colonialism by invitation. Okay, number two. Number two is the 2021 Organic Law for Special Economic Zones. This law was endorsed by both Maduro and the Venezuelan right-wing opposition, including Venezuelan Federation of Chambers of Commerce. It's important to note that this same Federation of Chambers of Commerce was one of the principal organizers that overthrew Chavez in 2002. So this special economic zone law grants power to the president to designate spaces where existing fiscal, financial, commercial, labor, and environmental laws do not apply. This opened the country up to foreign investment by giving large tax breaks to corporations, giving favorable access to natural resources, relaxing environmental regulations, and weakening labor rights. Venezuela now has the cheapest labor force in the world. Okay, number three. Number three is the 2018 Memorandum 2792, which, among other things, abolishes the right to strike, permits employers to unilaterally modify labor conditions and fire workers at their discretion. With this memorandum, Maduro dismissed all collective bargaining agreements in the country, eliminated much of what had been achieved under Chavez. The memorandum also undermines virtually all the labor rights enshrined in the Constitution and in the LOT Agreement of 2012. Labor leader Orlando Chirinos stated that no government anywhere in the world has produced a legal instrument as reactionary and anti-worker in the last 30 years as Memorandum 2792. And when dozens of labor leaders criticized the memorandum, they were arrested. Essentially, all legal worker gains achieved through the decades of struggle, Maduro erased with the stroke of a pen. Number four is the 2020 anti-blockade law, which effectively suspends the Constitution and grants extra constitutional authority to the executive branch for steering the economy. The law allows for both the president to relax and suspend legal and constitutional regulations and norms, and allows deals between the government and private capital to be carried out behind closed doors without any public knowledge of these agreements. These unsavory backroom deals with capital are carried out without being subject to legal or constitutional controls. This law has subsequently been used to open up the country to plunder by corporations, grant transnational corporations enormous incentives to invest in the country, and to expand the extractivist and accumulation rentier model, which is a major factor in the crisis. Okay, number five. Fifth is Maduro's refusal to maintain a minimum wage that equals a living wage. Under Chavez, the minimum wage reached above $300 a month. Today, it hovers around $2 to $3 a month. $3 is about what it costs to buy 2 pounds of meat. In other words, a monthly minimum wage is not enough to buy 2 pounds of meat. Venezuela went from having the highest minimum wage in Latin America to the lowest. Part of the reason why over 7 million, actually 8 million, it's a typo, 8 million Venezuelans fled the country was to work abroad in order to send remittances back to Venezuela, since one cannot simply survive on minimum wage alone. Maduro's minimum wage policy is also a violation of Article 91 in the 1999 Chavista Constitution, which guarantees that every worker has a right to a salary sufficient to cover basic material, social, and intellectual needs for themselves and their families. The Constitution states that the minimum wage is to be adjusted annually using the basic market basket as a reference. Not only does the minimum wage fail to provide a living income, but an average salary alone is also insufficient for basic survival. And I just want to add one thing really quick. What's called in Venezuela the basic basket is a collection of things that you need to survive, so food, medicine, toothpaste, toothbrush. This costs about $1,000 for the basic basket. So if you make $3 a month, it costs $1,000 to survive. Basically, you need to work 27 years to survive for 1 month. Does that make sense? So remittances are important in this case. Okay, number six. Number six is a 2017 constitutional law against hate, which establishes prison sentences of up to 20 years for persons convicted of so-called hate speech per its stipulations. The law was ostensibly passed to curb speech that incites hatred against any person or group on social media. But it makes it more difficult for journalists, media outlets, labor organizers, activists, political parties, civil society leaders to be critical of the government. This law has been used to repress dissent, including imprisoning activists, labor leaders, for criticizing actions of the government. I was going to give an example, but I'll skip it and we'll come back later. So the gains of the Chavez era were not simply reforms that were handed down from Chavez, but rather a product of the complex and often contradictory relationship between Chavez and massive popular mobilization from below. Resistance and popular mobilization from below were essential in deepening and radicalizing the Bolivarian process during the Chavez era. Attempts by Maduro to stifle the same popular mobilization has weakened the most important component in the successes of the early years of the Bolivarian process. Repression alone, and certainly not the law against hate alone, can explain the weakening of popular forces in recent years, but has certainly contributed to the demobilization and weakening of the organization of popular sectors. Seventh, which is the last one, I promise. Seventh is Maduro's policy of privatization, which more resembles the policies of the era that preceded Chavez than those of Chavez. The Maduro government privatized major branches of industry, including oil, iron, aluminum, gold, diamonds, and petrol distribution, which the latter, by Venezuelan law, is a function that is reserved to the state. Many of Maduro's privatizations were reversals of the very same industries that Chavez had previously nationalized, handing back to the private capitalist class that which Chavez had taken, like reverse appropriation. The crisis taking place in Venezuela, therefore, is not a crisis of socialism, the collective and democratic control of the means of production, nor of attempts to achieve socialism. Rather, it is a crisis of a strategy of working within the confines of capitalism and making concessions to powerful sectors of the capitalist class in lieu of confronting them. It is an existent crisis that has been profoundly exacerbated by U.S.-imposed sanctions. None of these elements should be ignored when explaining the crisis. None of these should be defended by the left, and none of these were necessary responses to the fall of oil prices or the enactment of U.S. sanctions. Rather than confronting the capitalist class in any serious way, rather than any meaningful transformation of social property relations, rather than challenging the prerogatives of transnational capital, rather than breaking with extractivism or breaking in dependence on export of minerals and hydrocarbons, the Maduro government made the working class pay for the crisis. An actual serious confrontation with the capitalist class could not be done purely as a political legal decision by Maduro or even a Chavez. A serious confrontation capable of meaningfully challenging social property relations would depend on the kind of radical massive popular mobilization from below, which deepened the Bolivarian process during the Chavez era. In fact, it would need to go much deeper. Raising the horizon to serious confrontation with capital would mean on the governmental level making decisions to unlock support and rely on that radical mobilization from below and allowing it to contest, transform, and attack capitalist social relations and the regime of private property. It is not simply the decisions of governments that could confront the capitalist class, but rather the decisions of government that could allow the forces from below to carry on that confrontation. This more revolutionary change could be supplemented, expanded, and defended through the actions of a left government, but the principal actor has to flow through extra-parliamentary channels, through powerful movements from below capable of implementing democratic workers' power. It's crucial that the international left opposes sanctions imposed on Venezuela, which have significantly curtailed Venezuela's international trade and severely impacted national revenue and consequently caused untold pain and misery for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. But our position in standing in solidarity with Venezuelans in their struggle for liberation cannot stop at just opposing sanctions. Maduro has proven to be an obstacle to socialism more than a vehicle. The international left must be in solidarity with the Venezuelan people, not with a corrupt and repressive capitalist government, even if they cloak themselves in socialist and anti-imperialist rhetoric. Lending support to Maduro government undermines our ability to support and stand in solidarity with genuine working class movements in Venezuela who are organizing against both U.S. imperialism and against Maduro's authoritarian rule and anti-worker neoliberal economic program. The left should fight against these politics and policies regardless of whether the regime carrying out this program uses capitalist, socialist, or anti-imperialist rhetoric. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.